I've mentioned already that Ecclesiastes is a remarkable book. It's one of my favourite books in the entire Bible. It speaks to us so clearly about the situation in which we find ourselves in. Now, one of the most popular television programmes over the last 20 and more years has been Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? I'm sure you've all seen it. Each week, contestants try to answer questions and increasing the prize money and ultimately winning £1 million. It's a far cry from an old episode of Bullseye I happened to come across recently where one of the prizes was gold-plated cigarette lighters. Compare that with £1 million. Who wants to be a millionaire? And deep down, how many of us would really quite like the idea of winning or being given £1 million? Now, of course, we'll think about, well, there are all the good things we could do with the money. You know, the charities we could support, the worthy causes that we could give to. But then again, we can't help coming back to the fact that, well, yeah, but I could get a new car, or maybe a holiday home, or maybe just never have to work again. We'll pay lip service to the maxim, well, money isn't everything. But then we'll slip back into thinking, well, what could we spend that money on? And time and again, the Bible speaks to us about money and material possessions. And we see that very clearly in the book of Ecclesiastes. Without doubt, Ecclesiastes is one of the most puzzling books in the Bible. At first glance, it does seem incredibly pessimistic. Such is the frequency with which we come across the word meaningless, if you're using the NIV, or vanity, if you're using the AV or the ESV translations of the Bible. Vanity, in the sense of futility or pointlessness. There's no denying that Ecclesiastes does not at times make for comfortable reading. Going through it is more like reading a broadsheet newspaper in the aftermath of a national tragedy or disaster. It's not like reading a glossy magazine that you might pick up in a dentist surgery or wherever, which recounts the lives of the rich and famous, where everyone's happy, where life is one long party. Now, in Ecclesiastes, we read about life as it is, not life as we would like it to be. And the writer of Ecclesiastes is relentless, often to the point where you are gasping for breath and repeatedly rubbing your nose in the grim reality of life. Now, the author of Ecclesiastes is not known for certain. It's thought to have been Solomon, and that it may well have been Solomon, but I'm going to call him by the name he gives himself, the preacher. Now, the preacher is not, as might be surmised from a superficial reading of his book, a natural pessimist, or even someone who has a rather cynical view of life. He is, in fact, a true believer in God, someone who has a proper understanding of who God is and who he is in relation to God. And throughout his book, the point he is trying to make is that life is happiest, most joyous, and most fulfilling when we live for God. And the opposite of that is that when we live for ourselves, when we live for the things of this world, then life is frustrating and futile. And what we find in this passage is that both of these lifestyles are on display. Now, the first section of this passage is found in verses 10 to 12. And here the preacher deals with three lies that the world tells us about wealth and possessions. three lies the world tells us about wealth and possessions. Now, the writer of Ecclesiastes is a great observer of what goes on in the world around him. He's one of these people watchers. He doesn't look at the world through rose-tinted glasses. He sees life for what it is. And in these verses, he critiques or he tests the assumptions that the world holds up about wealth and material possessions. And you might say he's demolishing the arguments and shattering the illusions that are held up to him about materialism. First of all, he deals with the lie that money and possessions satisfy. Well, do they? No, the preacher observed that these things are far from satisfying. Verse 10, he who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. Okay. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. Or this is futile. There's futility in this. Rarely will you find someone who is satisfied with the size of his bank account, a millionaire, a billionaire, someone who is truly content with the size of his investment portfolio. There's something addictive about money. For many people, no matter how much they have, they always want more. And for many people, tragically, money is their god. Money is something they worship with a fervency that controls everything they do. And yet, ultimately, it does not bring satisfaction. The second lie the world tells us about money and possessions, we find in these verses, is that materialism will always bring enjoyment to our lives. And here again, the preacher critiques this assumption. And he observes that, in actual fact, wealth and possessions often bring few pleasures to those who possess them. The first part of verse 11 reads, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. Now, this might possibly be referring to those hangers-on who suddenly appear when someone becomes wealthy, latch on to them, and move on when the money runs out. They have no real attachment to the person other than the material benefits that it brings. In America, it's known as the posse syndrome. And many rich and famous people have suffered from it. Michael Jackson or Elvis. It's not just the rich and famous who attract an entourage of hangers-on. Anyone who comes into money unexpectedly, whether through an injury payout or a lottery win, can all of a sudden find they have a whole new set of friends that they never knew they had before. What is it that all of a sudden has made this person so attractive to them? Is it their personality? Are they a fun person to be with? No. It's none of these things. It's because they now have, all of a sudden, lots of money and presumably need help in trying to spend it. The rest of verse 11 reads, and what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? And the implication there is that the one who possesses great wealth does not get to enjoy it himself. He has to watch while others benefit from what belongs to him. There's something ironic about this. The parents of teenage children know how quickly their money disappears when their offspring are around. How much more galling is it when the beneficiaries of your hard work are nothing more than a bunch of hangers-on. The third lie that the world tells us about wealth and possessions is that they bring peace of mind. Once again, the preacher brings his powers of observation and concludes that far from bringing peace of mind, wealth and possessions can be the source of much anxiety. Verse 12, sweet is the sleep of a labourer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Now there are two ways of interpreting this. One is simply that the rich diet of the wealthy man, far from satisfying him, only leaves him with indigestion, causing him sleepless nights. The poor man, by contrast, has a simpler diet, but one that is easier on his stomach. But it's generally accepted that there's more to this verse than that. And in speaking in general about the fact that the abundance of the rich man permits him no peace of mind. On the other hand, the labourer has fewer cares and fewer reasons for insomnia. Which position is it more preferable to be in? Which of us would trade a good night's sleep for wealth? We've been enjoying some beautiful weather over the last couple of weeks. Long sunny days. And unfortunately, long hot nights. I'm sure many of you have struggled to sleep in the heat. But which of us would trade being able to get a good night's sleep for wealth? Is that enough to get up in the morning for? I think not. Take the example of something as innocuous as going out to buy a new car. I'm sure many of us have done that at one time or another. Maybe not a brand new car, but certainly a newer car than the one we had before. Now, there may be a certain peace of mind in having a new car. Maybe the old car was a bit unreliable and a habit of breaking down in the most inconvenient of situations. But lots of other anxieties all of a sudden arise that we didn't have before. Maybe with the old car, third-party insurance was fine. But now we feel we have to go fully comprehensive. The consequence of that is that our insurance bill shoots up by maybe several more £100. The old car might have had a few bumps and bangs, but we weren't really bothered about them. Now, however, even the tiniest mark on our new car will infuriate us. And then we worry about where to park it. The old car, it didn't matter so much as you didn't think anyone was ever going to steal it. Now you worry about taking it out at night at all. In case someone, it might become a target for thieves. Or someone might come along and put a big scratch in it. All these anxieties simply over a new car. So much for peace of mind. So in these verses, 10 to 12, the preacher shatters the lies that wealth and possessions bring. First of all, satisfaction. They don't. They only make us want more. Secondly, enjoyment. Well, not if we can't keep the hangers-on away. And thirdly, peace of mind. No, they can just create greater anxiety. The second section of this passage covers verses 13 to 17. And one commentator has called this passage, Wealth Loved and Lost. And here the preacher is moving on from his observations on wealth and possessions, that they're unsatisfying, that they don't bring the pleasures hoped for, that they fail to give peace of mind. He's moving on from that to reflect on circumstances in which the love of money and materialism has caused misery and frustration. Verses 13 and 14 read, "There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is the father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand." First of all, riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. Now, the preacher doesn't tell us specifically what he's referring to here, but the intention is clear. Wealth actually brought more harm to the rich man than good. Maybe that he was so consumed with making money that he missed out on the things that really matter in life. Perhaps it's referring back to the sleepless nights of verse 12 and the anxiety and worry of those who fear losing their possessions. Many commentators have used the example of J.D. Rockefeller as someone who was seriously affected by the hold that wealth and possessions had on him. Age 53, he was the world's only billionaire. Yet in acquiring a fortune, he had lost his health. He had grown old, old beyond his time, before his time. Someone who met him said that he looked like the oldest man in the world. It didn't look like he would last much longer. But before it was too late, he recognized the destructive hold that money had on him, and he began to do something about it. He started giving his money away to various causes, charitable, religious, medical, educational, in all something like $550 million. His health began to improve, and he lived to be just short of his 98th birthday. By freeing himself from the hold that money had on him, Rockefeller was able to lead a much more rewarding life. Returning to the passage, we're told that these riches that had caused such harm were lost in a bad venture. And again, the preacher does not spell out for us exactly what he's talking about here, the specific circumstances in which this took place. It might have been losses sustained through extravagance, or maybe gambling, or even just a sudden reversal of fortune. And we're all too aware in this present age of the dangers of making bad investments, the uncertainty of the markets, fluctuations in currency, the rising price of fuel, have all left us feeling far from secure at times. And the result of this loss of wealth, as the preacher tells us, is that the once rich man now has nothing to hand over to his son, to his heir. All his work, his sweat, his toil, and what does he have to show for it? He'd worked hard to pass on an inheritance to his son, but that wasn't to be. In verse 15, we read the oft-quoted saying, "Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs." Ask the man at the funeral of the wealthy individual, how much did he leave? "He left everything," was the reply. Everything. Although it is something of a cliche, the saying, you can't take it with you. But it's as true now as it was nearly 3,000 years ago when the preacher wrote these words. And the picture presented by the preacher of the individual trying to find contentment in materialism is really quite disturbing. He concludes verse 17 with, "All his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation, and sickness and anger. Is that a life that any of us would want to lead? It'd be totally irrational to want that sort of lifestyle. But why is it that we persist in it? Why can't we see the pointlessness of it? You see, if you're looking for satisfaction in the things of this world, then you're expecting more from life than it can give you. Materialism is nothing more than a series of broken promises. We're promised much, but ultimately we're left with disappointment. It pretends that it can make us happy, that it can bring us fulfillment. And for a time, we might be happy with our new purchases. But it's hardly life transforming. And time and again, the Bible shows us that the attachment to material things is one of the main barriers that divides us from God. Wealth can give rise to notions of self-reliance. It can fool us into thinking that we're secure. God can easily be set to one side. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, you read this warning that God told Moses to impress on the minds of the children of Israel. Beware, lest you say in your heart, "My power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth." You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you power to get wealth. And yet we know that the reality for the children of Israel is that they repeatedly turned their back on God. There's no more profound statement on the foolishness of placing our confidence in worldly possessions than the words that we've read already from Luke, where Jesus himself says, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And that statement runs totally counter to how the world in general places value on human beings. By the standards of the world, your wealth, or your worth rather, is measurable in what you possess, the size of your bank balance, the type of car you drive, where you live, where you holiday. All of these things are indicators of success or lack of it. But Jesus says, he warns people, he warns those listening. No, your life is not about what you possess. Material possessions do not give you meaning. Wealth does not equal worth. What gives us significance and meaning is in our personal relationship with God through Jesus. And that is worth more than all the riches the world can ever offer us. Having well and truly rubbed our nose in the grim reality of life, of a life lived from material things, the preacher pauses to offer some encouragement. And the next three verses are one of a number of short passages dropped into the book of Ecclesiastes at various intervals that are designed to encourage us to live lives of practical faith. You might say that having looked at the futility of finding satisfaction in life through material things, the preacher outlines the remedy to this flawed way of thinking. And so in the final part of chapter 5, he looks at true contentment in life. And he makes two main observations here. The first is that it's possible to find enjoyment in your work, your toil, your activity. The second is that if you do take enjoyment from what you have, it is the gift of God. Verse 18, "Behold, "What I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot." Other versions might say, "For this is his reward." At first glance, it almost sounds like a call to eat, drink, and be merry. To follow the deeply flawed way of thinking of the farmer in Luke chapter 12, who had such an abundance of crops that he decided to pull down his barns, build greater ones, take it easy, relax, eat, drink, and be merry. To forget about your worries, have a good time, seize the day, live like there's no tomorrow. No, that's not at all what the preacher is saying here. What he is saying is that it's good to find enjoyment in our toil, in our work, in our activity. For some people, the ideal life is one without activity or toil. It's lounging around all day at the pool or on the beach. It's never having to work again. Now, certainly it's nice to have a break from the routine, but not a 365-day-a-year holiday. Now, work is not the curse that some might believe. It's something that God gave us and intended us to enjoy. Moreover, God is the one who allows us to enjoy what we have. Verse 19, "Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God." And when you actually think about that, when you pause and think about that, that's an amazing thing. Satisfaction in what we have is the gift of God. That's a very precious gift. Whatever you have in life, if you can take enjoyment from it, thank God for that. See, that, as the Bible explains to us again and again, the answer to the challenge of materialism is not to have more, but to accept and enjoy what we already have. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul writes, "Now there is great gain in godliness with contentment, for we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content." And that's a challenge for us, to live lives of contentment, to show that we are different from the world around us, to show that we are living with eternity's values clearly in view. All of us, and I include myself in this as well, all of us need to think seriously about where our life is going and realize that the things that bring us contentment are not our material possessions. Those things, in fact, could be spoiling our relationship with God and with his people. The things that really matter, ultimately, where we'll find satisfaction, is in our relationship with God through Jesus Christ. The chapter closes with a glimpse of the ideal life for the believer. Verse 20, "For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart." Now, that does not mean that life for the believer will be so uneventful that he will have nothing worth remembering from it. What it means is that for the person who finds enjoyment in his work, who's received that gift of enjoyment from God, who understands and acknowledges that, life will be wonderfully fulfilling. So much so that you won't notice the days pass by. You won't keep looking back full of regret. Let's pray that God in his mercy would make all of us like that. I close with the following verse that was penned by Rockefeller when he'd reached the age of 86. I was early taught to work as well as play. My life has been one long happy holiday, full of work as well as play. I dropped the worry on the way, and God was good to me every day. Amen.